This is at Trustworthy Slav.
This is at Incognito, COH.
CRKBlack.com build.
This is the Fed Post.
People on Twitter and on, but we haven't really had like an official person running for office on. So you're the first person on here, and I think it's a good first because you know, I've heard you say that you're post-partisan, which sounds good to all of us, all three of us for sure.
It sounds good to everybody when I say I'm a post-partisan solution in my mayoral lodge. They all started cheering, and I'm like, y'all know what that shit is? And I guess that's easy. I said, it sounds good. I'm like, there you go. I think it's just everybody's kind of over it. The numbers are clear that the majority of Americans are rejecting a duopoly, mm-hmm. or they're demanding more of their parties, or they're doing the old switcheroo again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm someone who's like a former lib, I guess we all kind of were to some degree, and you know, I mean, we're all checked out of the Democrats and the GOP. You know, I'm not sold on at all, really.
Of course not.
that's exactly what I want to hear. But yeah, I'm just wondering how did you get into politics? Like, how did you come to being post-partisan and running independent? Like, what were the steps that led you to running for office as an independent candidate?
So this is not my first office run. I ran for city council in 2020, the pandemic year. And I did it because I saw the pendulum swinging for politics. And a big part of that was Trump's election and how he was able to, I mean, the Bushes are a super powerful family, and they ran the Republican Party. It was their party. They had father and son, and the son got reelected, and, you know, the brothers are governors, and Florida, you know, stole the first election, and, you know, we had a lot of elections stolen in America. It's not a new phenomenon, but,
yep.
You know, and that was, they're powerful, super powerful, and Trump took him out with some jokes and populism. It wasn't even that sophisticated brand of populism. It was very effective because of the timing. The timing was the thing that he got the best, not actually the implementation, mm-hmm. mainly due to his lack of statesman skills and self-awareness. And this is just all my opinion, no disrespect to Donald. But he's not a good statesman. So
yeah,
you know, and you gotta, if you're gonna have integrity issues from the onset, you've gotta be more than just likable and funny. You've gotta be able to run the show, right? Mm-hmm. So that hurt him in the long run. But in terms of his ascension, it was very good education for me. And so what led to politics was, you know, I always avoided politics when I was a union organizer. And I literally would be like, look, I'll get the union members ready to go, and I'll get them to understand the importance of local politics, but I don't want anything to do with it. I want to spend my time talking to workers and getting people better pay and benefits or whatever, you know, safety stuff they need on a job or whatever they want, whatever the issues are in the workplace. And that's kind of what I want to focus on. That's why I got into the whole union thing. And if you want to focus on the, you know, the social justice or the politics, that's cool. The members will be there and accounted for, so you can do your thing. And I do my thing. And just make sure, you know, I get them all gamed up and organized and whatnot. And that was my, I hated it. It was just so vapid. It's the worst. The worst environment. It's never about what it seems to be about. And it's just such a toxic place to be. Mm-hmm. And it sounds crazy why I would do that. So, but then 2020 hit And I noticed that you put in your notes the financial, what I think was the beginning of, I mean, it's hard to say the beginning, but 2019, when we started our overnight repo markets and the banks started putting like mad and having stopped throughout COVID, and we all, people who were following sort of knew we were going to have to do some kind of major stimulus to get us out of it. And lo and behold, here comes the pandemic, and you know, there's money everywhere for everybody. It's, you know, the closest version to helicopter money to the people I've seen, unless they go for another round, to which it's just going to be disastrous at this point. And I mean, we definitely can get into the financial part of this is a big reason why I got into politics, even though local, that doesn't cover that scope of responsibility, but it was a motivating factor with me sort of seeing, okay, we're going to go through the greatest depression. America's going to lose the dollar. We're going to lose the golden credit card. We're going to have to make stuff again. We're going to have to, you know, put, you know, be productive and face the consequences of our divestment of our elite and our divestment from our communities that we've consented to because we haven't voted the right people. We've allowed ourselves to be bamboozled and hoodwinked repeatedly by people who obviously don't have our interests in mind. They've shown that over the course of decades. And yet every election season, just like here in Oakland, it's the same version here in Oakland. Every election season, here they come with, you know, more platitudes and a sense of urgency never seen. And people are like, well, they're doing it right now. And I don't want to interrupt. Finally getting to these people and they're doing stuff for me. And they fall for it again and again. And so I entered because I saw that there's going to be an emerging candidate. You see it in Schellenberger. You see it all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a tidal wave of postpartisan candidates in the coming decade. And so I wanted to, you know, get in on the fun and see how that would be able to help Oakland out, get ready for what I saw coming. Escalating crime, shortages, and, you know, PREPA stuff, SJST for the PREPAs out there, and WROL and all the, you know, when the balloon goes up and the world, the end of the world as you know it, and all the acronyms for the PREPAs out there like myself who've been preparing for a few years for the days that we're entering right now. And so I wanted to be able to make that message mainstream and palatable for people in Oakland, because if you can do it in Oakland, then you can do it anywhere. This is ground zero. And that's something I really want your listeners and anyone who's hearing this to, if you don't take anything else away, know that Oakland has a chance to elect as a mayor a post-partisan candidate who's rejecting this retarded woke shit that's just absolutely insane. It's anti-worker, it's anti-foundational class. It's absolutely elitist. People are rejecting it roundly in our community. And we can do that if you support. But because we're an independent candidate who's taken on Oakland special interest, on one side you have developers and the business community, on the other you have your nonprofits and the labor, the public sector labor unions, then we're going to need to be funded by the people, and we're going to need some support nationwide. So definitely give a dollar or two to our campaign. I know that people are hurting right now, and this is one of the toughest financial times we can muster. So if you ain't got it, you ain't got it. Don't feel stressed at all. But if you got it, to send that fiat my way. I need that fiat and that bank account to fight this fight. And give whatever you can if you believe that in what you're hearing throughout this message. So I got involved with an urban agriculture platform, a platform of pragmatism. And the experiment was this. I wanted to take out of my language any identifiers of a party and just speak to the issues and see what happened. And last election, I fucked up because I let my campaign manager convince me that I had to register as a Democrat, which I wasn't. I never have registered for a party in my life. always voted, you know, I've always voted Democrat, I would say, every time I voted prior, which because I was a union guy and Republicans just had anti-labor policy. Like, you know, it was, I don't know why, but they seemed to, you know, they were the business party, and the business party didn't like unions, and that was the dichotomy for some time. That's changing now, but it hasn't changed when it comes to policy at the highest levels. They still haven't switched the colors when it comes to supporting pro-union legislation. And I think that they would be wise to do so, mm-hmm. because if they can scoop Team Blue on that, the proof will now be in the pudding. It won't be just performative. You actually were back pro-labor legislation to make it easier for workers to unionize. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they would do that, but anyway, let me get back on track.
So
I should have let her convince me to do that, but the first election, we only spent $8,000 and we got 2,200 votes in the city council election. And that was pretty good. It encouraged me to start a nonprofit, Neighbors Together. We filed a lawsuit against the city for failure to follow this homeless policy. They passed a homeless encampment policy that legalized public camping, but provided a list of do's and don'ts and made it illegal to have a camp 50 feet from a school, business, resident, park, or critical infrastructure. At the height of the election, weeks before we voted, purely performative, and then gaslit us and didn't do it because the activist was on his shit the whole next year. So I got a bunch of money from some developers and former nonprofit and sued them, and it hit. The first news coverage, they covered me as vocal grassroots nonprofit contract homeless advocate. And then I forced them into a public debate, which they hate to have because they're a bunch of zealots who don't want to debate. Mm-hmm. And because I'm an activist and organizer and, you know, I have a body of work and the movement that speaks for itself, and these are my allies or former allies, some of them, they had to, like, actually talk to me about it. And they just kept moving the goalposts to, like, we want permanent housing with no strings attached. And I'm like, that is absolutely contemptuous of people. They're like, it's just crazy. You guys are whacked out. And we exposed them. And the news now, the spoils of war was that, I'm kind of speeding this up because it's not like, I don't want to be too Oakland-focused here for your viewers who are not in Oakland. But the spoils of war was, we're not homeless advocates. We're the housing advocates if you Google me and Wikipedia and stuff. I ain't never worked in no housing advocacy. That was just me taking on in a public debate and beating them and showing people that, look, you don't have to be scared of these folks. They're not actually good at debating. If you can get them into a battle of ideas, you can crush them like a bug because they don't have any fucking ideas. They're a bunch of brainless zombies.
Yeah, hive mind.
And you can get them into that. And here's another thing. The people who are not brainless zombies who have been following them because they're the only vocal people speaking up for the disenfranchised, you actually will win over a lot of people who you think are, I don't even like to use the word woke anymore because it's identifier, but the people who are falling for the okey-doke who are being useful right now, they can be awakened. A lot of them are actual ready allies if presented with better information. Mm-hmm. Or a better movement to help people. So I don't want to be too attacked. There's Dakota people who work in social justice or who want to fight for poor and disenfranchised people. They have good intentions and they need to be uplifted and celebrated. They just need to pick better leaders who actually care about those things and aren't going to play them, you know?
Definitely.
So that's kind of more what I'm getting at. So I ran to give a voice to that. And then the mayor thing was like, there's some stuff in Oakland. Like, check this out. Do you guys want to? Should I keep going? You want to ask me questions or break it up? I don't want to die.
Oh, you can keep going. You can keep going. You can just kind of soak it in and then ask any questions when you're done.
Yeah, this is great.
Okay, cool. Perfect. I'm going to take another like 6 minutes to give a layout for Oakland.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oakland, California is it's the only one of the top 10 cities in California, of which we are number 8. Who does not have a strong mayor form of government. And you guys know the difference between a city manager form of government and a strong mayor form of government?
Not particularly. You want to outline that for us?
Most people don't. And herein lies the details and why we can win a selection and why people are giving me money. The Oakland's elite are waking up like, oh, this guy's actually on to something. In 1997, Jerry Brown, former governor of California, then mayor of Oakland, tried to move Oakland from a city, from a city manager form to a strong mayor. And here's the difference. A city manager means you have a city council who's elected. That city council then hires collectively a city manager who's unelected. And that city manager runs the city. And that city council hires and fires that city manager at their discretion. And smaller cities employ this model primarily, not larger cities. Very few big cities, and by big cities, I mean cities of 300,000 or more, employ this type of model. Gotcha. And Oakland has been a transitional city from about that to now just under 500,000. We're also a port city. So in wanting to grow and put on our big boy pants, Jerry Brown tried to move Oakland to a strong mayor government. And a strong mayor means the mayor has direct responsibility for running the city. They have a vote on, they're not ceremonial. They have a vote on council. They have line item veto over the budget. And they hire and fire department heads. And they can actually have the responsibility and accountability of doing whatever you voted them to do. Mm-hmm. So Jerry Brown tried to do that in 97, and he tried to move to a strong mayor, and it failed. He repackaged it as Measure X. He kept the strong mayor branding, but the actual guts of the plan was a compromise called a hybrid model, where the city manager and city council, it's hella confusing, bro. It just doesn't make no sense. But anyway, it was a compromise. And it's taught a hybrid model between the two, a very experimental. I don't know of any other city who's done it. And we're the only city in the top 10 cities with it. And it ain't working. Last year, this policy think tank group called Spur, like a horse, like you spur a horse, mm-hmm. put out some recommendations called Making Government Work. And on this, all the people running for mayor were consulted. And one of the recommendations was to try again for a strong mayor. And I watched every single person who was running for mayor launch. And none of them mentioned it. And I'm like, hold on, this is the answer. We don't have any accountability in government because of two reasons. One is our culture, but another is our structure. And mm-hmm. both need to be addressed. It's absolutely a structural issue. And it's a systemic lack of accountability because there's no clear delineation of power. Mm-hmm. And Spur breaks it down. It did the white paper. It did all the fucking homework. Why don't you run on it? And they didn't run on it. So I started asking around, hey, man, why people ain't running on it? And they're like, oh, well, you know, it's controversial and the unions are like, well, it's just too much to take on right now. Mm. And I'm like, nah, but that's the actual answer to why the cities are fucked up. I'm going to run on it and fucking scoop you guys. And I'm going to educate, then agitate, and then organize, the good old tried and true plan of a union organizer. Mm-hmm. And organizing means get the vote out, and then we're going to win off of this. And slowly but surely, check this out. I put my website out, which is clearly the best website in the race. If you Google Seneca Scott Oakland, had fun for a few hours. If you Google whatever, whoever else is running Oakland, had fun for a few minutes. Our bandwidth is just not even close to these other people. We're just doing so much shit. And I mean, we're not getting enough credit for it. I finally hired a comms director, so she's going to get our stuff out more because I've been trying to wear too many hats. But basically, we were willing to go for that and sell it. And it started working. And slowly but surely, here's what happened. If you go to our website, bro, Oakland's mayor basically has our website. And they're going down the list and they're doing each thing like, oh, here's what we need to be doing now. Oh, here's what we need to be doing now. It's almost comical. Like, and I'm able to take that because I'm on like, you know, Oakland Builders Alliance and development boards and like, you know, fancy like a leader's board so I can be with where the money is. And I'm like showing these people this stuff like, hey man, like check it. Like you peeped this, right? Like, look, Libby's been a mayor for 8 whole fucking years. And she didn't say none of this. And then I put this on my platform, and within 5 months, she said exactly what I'm saying, verbatim, that this needs to be what happens to save the city. Come on, you got to give me some money, bro. Yeah. Like, you don't even know what it is, right? Like, come on, you playing yourself if you don't support me right now. So that's why I ran. I saw an opportunity, and we took it. And if we raise the money, we're going to win it. And the whole country is going to be like, what the fuck just happened in Oakland? Did an independent candidate who was very vocal about rejecting phony progressives and meek moderates on the left actually win a mayor? And what does that mean for anybody else being able to actually run and get their campaign funded, which is the biggest hurdle to politics, mm-hmm. is the money, right? That's what most people have to sell out to get it. And anyway, that's the long-winded 21-minute answer about why I got to the mayor's race, why I think we can win, and what the basic strategy is.
Nice. Yeah, that sounds great. It's definitely a change of pace from what you hear most politicians talking about, definitely. And I think your ideas about creating better structures for accountability, I mean, I think that speaks to everyone, because I think that we all know the politician who gets into office running on, you know, X promises, and then as soon as they're in office, those promises disappear, which is really mostly every politician, every mainstream one at least. So it's really great to hear, you know, that kind of, at least speaking to that as being an issue and something to work on. And as far as for Oakland in general, yeah, it seems almost like a no-brainer what you're saying, switching back to the more powerful mayor model, because there is that built-in credibility, that delineation is right there. And it's not surprising that it's controversial, because I'm sure that kind of obfuscation, that murkiness where you can't really tell who's in charge of what individual thing and who is and who isn't living up to promises, I'm sure that's very beneficial for, you know, certain individuals. So, you know, being able to come out and speak to that.
They love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think what you're talking about too, in terms of like there being a lane for postpartisan politics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you see that across the country, you see that with Trump, like you mentioned. And you know, I think, you know, what you're saying about how you were able to influence the mayor's positions, you know, it just brings to mind that like a lot of these people, these establishment GOP and DNC people, have been comfy for a very long time. They're used to like running races with low turnout and just sort of, you know, all saying the same things and having kayfabe. So as soon as someone comes in and just disturbs that or just isn't on the script, there's a wide lane there because they don't expect that, because they're used to the complacency, the jadedness, the cynicism that's across politics in general in America. Most people are checked out of politics. Most people don't vote.
Oh, yeah, so I think there's not generally.
Yeah, yeah, which is why there's that lane. And to just, you know, I think a lot of people psych themselves out of like, oh, we can't change this thing. It's too locked out. But I think they take for granted that because it's so locked in and there's been so much cynicism, there is a lane now because mm-hmm. no one expects that. No one expects you to come in and, you know, speak to things that people are actually interested in, because these guys are comfy. They're all comfy.
Here's the issue though, right? And this is the scariest part. The speed at which these chameleons will adjust, co-opt and adapt post-partisanship, you ought to see it happening.
Oh yeah.
Yes, for sure.
So you got to be real aware of that and watch. Also, absolutely, allow for people to have that change, right? That somebody could be in a position and say, hey, I've grown and I do want to do this now. But mm-hmm. it's just to demand some sacrifice at that point. You shouldn't be able to maintain your party affiliations. Yeah. And that's the thing for me, is that you're not for real unless you're willing to drop out to duopoly.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's something the way that
you really know. If you're not willing to leave the parties, I can't say you're super legit about being a solutionary or postpartisan. A great example, I don't know their party affiliation, And I'm really hoping that he can maintain his integrity. I don't know if you know this guy, Chris Smalls, the Amazon guy. I fucking love that guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome, right? I like how he was calling out AOC and all of that. But then he let him come, and then, you know, like I understand you got to play the game when these people got money, but you don't have to do that to get their money. They don't give it to you anyway, right? So, like, I wish he had some, you know, I'm not going to speak what I don't know, mm-hmm. and I hate to assume anything. But my concern, if Chris is listening or somebody who knows him is listening, is that he's got a lot of good instincts. And he's a gifted organizer. He's a savant of an organizer. I'm a union organizer. I've organized tens of thousands of workers. So I know exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. This guy is one of the best I've ever seen. Obviously, right? It's fucking obvious. Look what they did. It wasn't him, but look what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just part of the game. You got to get a contract, number two, which is the most important. And I know he knows that. And that's why he's working with people who can help with the contract fight, which is even more expensive than the organizing fight. But my concern is, you don't need to get it from them. You need to lay some clear demands down, and they need to kiss his ring.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? They need to suck up to the workers, because they're going to co-opt that shit.
Yeah.
The same way Black Lives Matter got co-opted. Mm-hmm. The same way, like, you're right? Like, you're going to co-opt that shit and use it for nefarious purposes. So the moment, like, if you got to demand an actual reason from AOC why she did not tweet or direct any money toward this fight. 100 racks? Bro, I raised more than 100 racks in a few weeks from some developers to sue the city.
Mm.
Come on, she connected. She could have raised a few hundred thousand with a one tweet.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of what you're talking about co-opting, you know, we all used to be Bernie people. That was originally what we were in like 2020 when we started the show. And, you know, I think he's a great example of that, of just someone who's in the machine. He's in the DNC machine. So is AOC. There was this idea that they were going to change it from the inside. And that's just ridiculous on his face, because
he's totally sold out. Now he's over here asking Biden $15 minimum wage. Right? Like, bro, come on, man. That time been passed. Stop it.
Yep.
Right? Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And he
campaigned for him harder than anybody else I ever saw was out there just like campaigning for him. So, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, there's this idea that you can change these behemoth machines, or that, you know, and then the reality is you can't change them. They're changing you. You coming on, you know, I was a little skeptical at first. I was like, oh, a politician, like, I don't know, I'm a little, you know, weary or whatever. But then, you know, I saw that you were running independent. That was already like a positive to me, because it's mm-hmm. like, all right, you've given up the benefits of being plugged into whatever machine. You've lost that benefit, but in the same sense, there's again that opening now where you can, you know, you can go a different way, mm-hmm. and you know, there is that opportunity, and people underestimate that there is that opportunity now, but I really believe there is now more than ever.
Oh, it's a gaping opportunity. I guarantee you. If I raise the $576,000 you got to raise to run for mayor or be competitive, I don't need a single pack. We will absolutely win this election. We've already talked to thousands of people. It's from every part of the city, everybody wants the same thing. I want safe streets. I want a hope for my community. Just, I mean, I don't even have to go into it.
We want opportunity,
right? We want opportunity. We don't want to have our wealth extracted. We don't mm-hmm. want to have people mocking our pain and telling us that they're careful for it, but they're absolutely contemptuous of poor people. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this from my own contemporaries that I went to Cornell with. And I turned 43 this month. Most of my friends I went to Cornell with are very well off, if not, soon to be wealthy or wealthy people. And I mean, if they hedge or, you know, took some of my advice to buy some high tangible assets, depending on how this next few months and years go with this market, we'll see if they hold on to it. But nevertheless, you know, these are high net worth people and they make a lot of money. They're very accomplished. They're brilliant. And they're absolutely contemptuous of the poor. It's like, bro, you grew up poor. You forgot?
Yep.
Like, it's so easy to forget because why would you want to, you know, deal with anything like that? And that's the thing about being elite in America is you privatize everything. And if you privatize everything, then you become detached from the experiences of what the majority of people are going through. And that's what's leading to a very important divide right now. But in that divide is a tremendous opportunity, like you just said. I think people are waking up. People are, like I said, it's being co-opted already. That's my concern. Yes. Yeah. It's already being co-opted. Like, my talking points are already being co-opted. In my own city, I'm like, oh, you guys, what? Okay. I see what you did there.
Yeah, I remember watching Bernie talk about Medicare for All, and then the other Democrats started talking about it, and then the meaning of Medicare for All just morphed over in real time in a couple months. All of a sudden, it meant public option. All of a sudden, it meant, like, subsidies. Like, it just morphed, and then nobody even knew what it mean, and it was burned. Like, so that's always a concern. But yeah, I mean, it's good to hear that you're having success, and you know, you're definitely, you know, any success that you have or anybody else has is contagious, and it gives sort of a, you know, it makes other people realize that there is the opening if they're, you know, currently thinking that it's more bleak than it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a good thing. In terms of the accountability, what do you feel like would be a mechanism, that would assure that? So is the idea that because you would be running in a way where the mayor would have more power, that basically if things go wrong, people can hold you accountable because you're the one who's more in charge. Is that the general philosophy?
Yes, you can hold the office responsible, but you also can know that office has the actual ability to affect the change that they're running on. But that's only half of it. The other half is cultural. San Francisco, for example, has probably the strongest mayor in California because London Breed not only is the mayor, she also sits on the county board of supervisors because San Francisco as a city is also a county. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. And look at San Francisco. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So the power in itself is it an end all, or the accountability in itself isn't the end all, but at least people know that they can hold London Breed accountable and she should be doing these things and she has more power to actually implement change. And Oakland doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even worse is that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I said, even worse is that city council gaslights people. And every time you ask why nothing happens, they say, we have a strong mayor. We vote on it, and the mayor is empowered to implement it. And that's just a lie.
Yeah, they love to do that, right? They tell you just the exact opposite of the truth, down is up type logic.
Yeah, and even on a national scale, you think about, you know, the president and Congress, you know, they sort of get to, you know, lift their hands and just be like, oh, you can't blame me for this. You know, it's gridlocked in Congress. You know, they sort of all get to play kayfabe and blame each other and nothing happens.
I mean, or the previous guy.
Right. I mean, we're literally watching this happen with Roe v. Wade right now, right?
Yeah.
Just kind of tossing it back and forth, hot potato. It's pretty funny. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. I mean, it works.
You know, that was an op. That's controlled opposition. Roe v. Wade, come on. Right now, with all the stuff we're facing, this is what they drop on us.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, well, I mean, it's clearly for midterms, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane.
I think that's one level. There's a deeper level than that. It's for midterms. It's like politics as usual. We got to go to politics under. There's a quote I've been using a lot lately that gets me. It helps me set the room for people. To understand the urgency. There are decades when little happens, ooh, and there are weeks when decades happen.
Let's go, Lenin, baby. Let's fucking go.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Right? You're making CH very happy.
this ain't normal times. Y'all already feel me. This ain't normal times.
That's a fact. That's a fact.
So this is accelerated times that we're living in right now. And However you want to look at it, if you want to look at it from a religious perspective, from a metaphysical perspective, from a pendulum perspective, from an input-output perspective, however you want to look at it, right, from a policy perspective, it's a time of age of consequences and reckoning, mm-hmm. and yeah, when it's right. begun. So I think it's only part of it, like I said, is that element. There's another part to it.
Well, this is what I've been saying, bro, is we're going in, like, the two dominant parties are fucking running on. Okay, all right. all right. Context. The country is being fucking looted, like fucking post-Soviet, you know, Eastern Bloc, right? And just absolutely taking it up the ass right now. And the primary parties are running on abortion rights and education reform. And that's it. Those are the primary it's fucking crazy pills. It's crazy making. I don't understand. And it's not to say that like there's never a time to ever talk about either of those issues. It's just like, I mean, it's
order of operations, dude.
Operations, bro.
Yeah. I mean, the GOP and the DNC, they pushed all these bailouts for COVID and the bailouts for Ukraine. They're causing the inflation. They both do. So, you know, they're obviously going to avoid talking about that because they're both dirty. They're both complicit. So mm-hmm. it's smart for them to avoid that and focus on these things on the margin. But
It's just funny too, because it's like, well, yeah. I mean, I don't even want to get down the Ukraine and COVID rabbit hole necessarily.
Why right? not? Go for it. Go for it.
Well, it was actually funny because before you came on, we were wondering, you know, how safe that was to talk about. But I mean, you kind of seem like an open book. I mean, it's just it's insane. And I can't think of a better indictment of the duopoly, as you put it, right now than just the idea that like the GOP is kind of like the designated COVID critical party at a cursory glance. And then when it actually comes to any kind of strategic positioning or going into an election or anything, again, it's not really the platform at all, at least insofar as I'm viewing things right now. It's completely insane. I mean, it's basically just the point I was making a second ago. But yeah, I mean, of course, Ukraine's a little less surprising just because, like, you know, of course, Washington is just completely rotten with war hawks.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, yeah, it's just insane. And I mean, I'm sure that you have a ton to say about. I mean, I can't even imagine how COVID has affected Oakland. I mean, not that we have to even just limit the scope of the conversation to that, but yeah, I mean,
it's bad. We still are all boarded up and retail has fled.
Yep. That's all over the country. That's where I'm living at now too. Abandoned buildings everywhere. You know, the heart of downtown is boardered up with fucking plywood. You know, it's owned by these big development companies. They're not selling it to anyone local. They're just holding it, letting it kind of crumble. Small businesses were shuttered and no one really cares. Like life just kind of moves by it. And now we're talking about abortion and the city crumbles and people are left without homes and people, without
jobs. People are falling for it. And it's, but they're not falling for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's encouraging. The media will have you think they're falling for it, but I don't think people are falling for it. I think people are kind of like, I don't know. It looks like this is a little manufactured. Here's my perspective on the timing.
Let's do it.
Obviously, it looks like an op, but...
Yes.
Hey, yeah.
Here's how you call out Democrats. Hey, quick question for Democrats. Republicans have literally had single-issue Supreme Court nominees. They ask them one question. You go over to Tony Roe? Yep, all right, yeah. Right? Like, this is all they've been focusing on. Like, you knew this shit was coming. And now you act surprised. You know this was coming. This has been the agenda for a long time. The leak, that fact that it's a leak before August, makes me concerned about what's happening before August, because this could have happened in August and had the same effect on the election.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by look a little deeper. Let's peel back. The first obvious layer is, okay, the Dems want something for the midterms. So they leak something that's always there. The Republican... I'm always trying to overturn Roe versus Wade. You already know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that was happening when Trump appointed three justices. You knew what the stakes were when you ran Hillary and not Bernie, even though they cheated Bernie in California, where I live, by spending the California money on Hillary while she was running against Bernie. And that's the money supposed to go to the person who won this damn California primary. It's so blatant. Mm-hmm. It's just so obvious. And she lost. She lost straight up. There was no fuckery on that one. She lost straight up. People didn't like her. And they voted, you know, the way they voted. And the consequences were the Republicans got to appoint three people who were going to overturn Roe versus Wade. Everybody knew it. Everybody knew it. So you knew it was coming. So to act surprised, we all know that that's the first layer. The midterms is obvious. But here's the second. What's immediate around the corner? We see the formula shortages now. I'm not going to get too tinfoil hatty and say it's the beginning of significant food shortages, but food shortages have been on the horizon for some time. Mm-hmm. So if we do that, that's bad. You mentioned letting things happen with solutions. I'm in a nonprofit called Guardian Grains. Guardian Grains, if you look it up on your Googles, is a veteran-powered regenerative agriculture nonprofit where we try to get farms, we buy farms and farmlets and create parallel systems and communities that can help combat that, you know, find new purpose and meaning in their lives, but particularly special operations combat vets who have a unique, I don't know how to put it, burden, right? Yeah. Like they get asked to do some pretty heavy stuff and they can never talk about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they kind of share that in their own fraternity. And my friend Mark Mark, he's former Navy SEAL. He founded this group. And they also do like a lot of psychedelic and medicine work and things like that to help people, like, you know, unfuck their heads and not off themselves. The suicide rate are just insane from special operations combat vets. You know, it's insane. The survivor's guilt, like just all of it. Like just, anyway, let me move on. Well, Mark is like, look, bro, I know how this works. I've done this shit. This is what we do in other countries. We create a problem, and then we give you the solution, and in that solution is our agenda.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And that's what's happening right now. These problems are being... Because you look around, you're like, why are we doing this? What is going on? It only benefits one group. They're getting insanely... The wealth extraction is, like you said, there's a plunder right now. They're plundering, and they need to keep us distracted as long as they can.
Yep.
So my concern is, if you could have easily have done this in August, if it's truly what's coming and you didn't need to leak it, August ain't that far away. So why now? And what are they taking the attention off of?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And that's the different layers. And then, you know, it's just weird. It's just weird. The arguments on the left are just like not even like, they're missing opportunities because they're just not even advocating for what other countries have. They're like, no. We want you to be able to, like, I don't give a fuck. How long it is? It'll be the day before you. What? Huh? Like, that's not what other countries are doing. What are you talking about?
Yeah, that's not the popular, sentiment amongst most Americans
at all. So, like, why are you just not making it more about, you know, what it is, because you can't maybe win that argument, because then people start to entertain states' rights, and they start to entertain, right? And then they have to deal with, I mean, talking to people with, I had a person who, if you go to my Twitter for my mayor, somebody says, I heard you on Rare Candy, I loved it, if I was in Oakland, I'd vote for you. And I said, right on, man, thank you. And that's it. I didn't ask the guys a friend. I may have retweeted it. Who knows? At most, I retweeted it and said, thank you. Some girl chimes in. You're a mayor, candidate for mayor. This guy's tweet says, something mean about sluts wanting to get abortion. I don't remember what it said. What is, do you make a statement on that, or do you defend that statement, or whatever the hell? And I'm like, what the fuck?
You're like, I don't know this guy.
I don't know this guy. Like, what the fuck? I just said, I like you. I said, thank you. Like, fucking Twitter. But here's what I said. I said, body sovereignty is paramount. My body, my choice is four simple words for a reason. Now, that could be applied to a lot of things right now, right?
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
Like vaccines.
And when I say the left and right like to see themselves as 1 in 12 on a ruler, when they're really 1 in 12 on a clock, this is one of the best examples. Both of them are ignoring, both of them are saying, my body, my choice, and then being hypocritical at the same time. And I don't care about popular opinion aside, and this is maybe the libertarian in me. Look, as a person of faith, I will absolutely judge you for that. Not for getting an abortion, but for like late term shit, yeah, I'm gonna be like, yo, that's kind of grimy, fam. Like, you don't have to do that, you know? Like,
that's a little like, fucked I'm up, a, but all right.
That shit fucked up, bro. But I mean, like, the law, I'm not with the law. You know what I mean? Like, it's just your fucking body. Nobody gets to tell you what to do with your fucking body. That's the rule, right? And I defend that. I mean, I'm gonna judge you and condemn you and make sure you're an evil person, but that's nothing to do with the law. And we seem to keep forgetting that, and both sides have violated that and don't even see their own humor. And yeah. It's like, it's almost comical at this point, which is why most people are like, oh, I'm over red and blue.
I mean, there's a funny trend now of people even just acknowledging the hypocrisy and just saying, yeah, well, friend, enemy distinction, I don't care. I don't need any principles, because that's sort of their way of just realizing that it's been pointed out so many times that they don't really have an argument. So that's what they say. But yeah, I generally just view a lot of this culture war stuff as distraction from the economic changes that are going on, the looting that Slav just mentioned. And, you know, it's like you said, decades happening in years. Technology was already exponentially advancing things, but COVID just in the last 2 years accelerated a bunch of horrible trends that were already going on economically and socially. And, you know, it's like, you know, why are we talking about abortion? I don't give a fuck about this shit. I don't give a fuck about abortion and gender queer shit. I don't give a fuck about any of this shit. Everywhere I go, everything costs more. That's what I give a fuck about. And maybe it's selfish, but like,
I think you cut out there.
This is what I see in front of me. I don't want to be talking about this shit that we talked about from the 70s. I don't care about that shit. I really don't. I care about what's going on right now that is very visible and tangible in the last 2 years that affects everybody I know. So, you know, that's how I view a lot of that, like, you know, distraction shit or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we can get more into COVID and more into, you know, your ideas about collapse, because I know you mentioned I know you called yourself a prepper, and how, you know, urban agriculture relates into all that. I kind of want to get into the home. Oh, did we lose COH? Oh, there's COH. Okay.
Oh, he's good.
I wanted to get into the homelessness stuff, because I know that's a big issue in Oakland. But basically, could you know, what do you feel about what the best way to address the issue is? I mean, I'm in New York, so that's a big problem here as well. And, you know, we have Eric Adams here, who I don't know if you're familiar with.
He played y'all.
yeah, exactly. So he, you know, he conveniently comes in where COVID is causing all this mayhem, and he conveniently just comes in and says, "Oh, I'll fix the crime." And you know, I think his response with homelessness has just been like, "We're just gonna, you know, just the sledgehammer. Let's just bulldoze all the encampments and like push these people out of here." In the city, they used to bust homeless people out of the city to get the numbers down. You know, nothing to deal with what's actually causing it, just kind of like papering over, putting band-aids on things. But, you know, he's blaming drill rap for crime. You know, he's doing whatever he can to get out from under actually doing anything serious. But what do you, I think there's a range of ways people view the problem and what's causing it and what to do about it. But in general, what's your like overview of the whole situation? Well, in Oakland, I guess, specifically.
We have to be so here's the thing. I can talk about this all day, but here's the best example that I start with. We have a first. We have Oakland has a culture of permissiveness. We have a vaunted culture of permissiveness, if you will. And it's one of the reasons why I like living here. Like, I have like 6 goats, not whatever they're supposed to have. I have 50 chickens, not 12 or whatever they're supposed to have. And my neighbors don't care, and we all love it, so it works. And nothing happens, like other cities where you can't get away with stuff like that. So part of that is that we've just gone overboard with our permissiveness as a culture. So that's one thing. Another is we've created conditions where you have open-air drug markets that we've attracted, you know, thousands of people from all over the country to come here because it's the free-for-all. So that's another dynamic. So first you have to stop that. You can't create conditions where it's a free-for-all. Let me write some notes down so I can approach this really organized. So here's the first step. Let's say you can stop the bleeding. By that, I mean you stop any other homeless people from coming because they know this ain't the place to be. You're not gonna like have people just waiting on your hand and foot like a homeless butler.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's gonna be tougher to be here. You're gonna be asked to get clean. You're gonna be asked to get services. You're gonna be asked to accept housing that comes with course correction. So let's say we do that part, because that's a big part. And that takes what's called both public and political will. And the public will is the price tag associated with wraparound services needed for the unhoused. Because 70-80% easily are mentally ill and on drugs. And they need wraparound services like drug rehab or mental health services, inpatient, so they're not on the streets. And what did Amy Whitehouse say when you asked her to go to rehab? She said, no, no, no. So nobody does that shit willingly. So you're going to have to like make people do it. And people aren't comfortable with that here, and they're not comfortable with the price tag. Because imagine, like, you ain't paid your landlord full rent in 3 years, and you're one of the people who are not jerking them off. Like, you actually did, you know, have financial constraints from COVID and the shutdowns and all the shit, right? And you're on the verge of being homeless yourself. You can't keep up with inflation. You're going to sleep at night anxious about your finances. I mean, this is 60% of America. And you live somewhere that a politician wants to allot $200,000 per year to homeless people, per homeless person, or even more. Their first thing is, what the fuck? Hell no. Fuck them.
Right.
They made their bed, not sleep in it.
Right.
But that's not the answer. And the actual cost of doing the taxpayers is more. So if you told them that, they may be willing to say, okay, hey, we need to support you too. Here's some things we're doing to support you, but you also need to, like, not, let's not have a race to the bottom. You can maybe sell that to people if they see solutions for their own problems within those policies.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And that's the public world challenge. So here's another analogy I make. It's triage. Which is the part people ain't comfortable with, but we gotta start getting comfortable with triage real soon with what I think is coming to America. Now, let's say that we're in Haiti. I'm going to give you an analogy, a story I tell a lot that I've worked on a lot, so hopefully it goes over well. It usually works in Oakland pretty well. So you're in Haiti. I'm sipping my beer. You're in Haiti after the earthquake, and you're a first responder. Are any of you here familiar with first responder, the work you have to do if you're like in a crisis, a medical crisis, or triage?
No, not firsthand, no.
So basically what you do is you go to each person and you decide whether you're going to give them enough drugs to put them asleep and kill them and euthanize them, or you're going to save them. So either you make them comfortable to die or you save them. And you come out to the earthquake and it's all these people screaming for mommy, and you hear faint screams of help, and people can't scream anymore because they're dehydrated from screaming, and they stay three, so you hear them beating on whatever. You're using stethoscopes to find, like, people tapping stuff. the whole get out. It's intense. And when you pull the bricks off of them, you're going down a line all day long, like live, die, live, live, die, live, die, live, live, die. At the end of the day, you've got to deal with an enormous amount of pressure and guilt. And it's hard to get up the next morning and do it again. Matter of fact, you lose a lot of people the very first day. And there's actual psychiatrists out there with you who you can talk to, who are grief specialists, to tell you, hey, you didn't decide that. They would have died without you. Mm-hmm. So on and so forth. And you get them back out there to do the job, because if you didn't get back out there, more people are going to die. We have work to do. We need you here helping people who are dying. That's mm-hmm. triage. That's how it works. What they don't do is sit around and say, what's the root causes of Haiti's infrastructure due to systemic racism? And until we can figure this out, like, we're just going to let everyone just sit in a rubble, because this is a very important issue to find the root causes. And, you know, I'm using that voice because that's how these fucking people talk. No, you should start saving people. What are you doing? And when you say things like, hey, business owners are desperate because they're losing their businesses and small businesses because of crime, and, you know, they've been here their whole life and they've never dealt with these issues. And some idiot woke reporter says, well, actually, that is still crimes going down. And you want to smack him in a mm-hmm. fucking smug face. And it reminds you of a saying, hey, my roof's leaking. And you're like, no, it's not. I have to hear the study yeah. that says it's yeah. not. Like, are you serious? Like, it's only so long you're going to get away with that. And mm-hmm. that's so long.
So you got to have pragmatic stuff I mean. That you can do in the immediate, in the short term, you know, that can address the problems and stop the bleeding. That's kind of what you're saying.
Yes, and we need to change our laws. Every single person you talk to in California says, well, this is Reagan's fault for getting rid of the mental health hospitals. Y'all been saying that for a decade. How come you ain't made no new mental health hospitals? Mm. You in power. Yeah. Yeah. Progressive governor. Make more. Now all of a sudden during election year, Gavin's got his plan to make more mental health hospitals and commit people for up to a year. And now he's talking on top about what everybody's been saying has been the mm-hmm. solution forever. And now it's like, oh, no, I have this good idea, guys. Look, look, look. Like, come on. And, Are you serious?
Yeah. I used to be more against, you know, asylums or whatever, you know, but I had, you know, what you mentioned too, like a large percentage of the homeless people being mentally ill. Like my family member had gone bipolar and just kind of like lived out of a car and just was going insane. And we couldn't like get him help because we came up against this problem where we were like trying to get him help. Yep. Mm-hmm. And he refused, obviously, like the Amy Winehouse thing you're talking about. And then, you know, they were all the doctors and all the law were basically saying like, we can't do anything because he has civil liberties. We can't really force him into anything.
Yeah, we have to treat him with compassion while we allow him to die.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And it's something that I think when I was more liberal, whatever, I like thought I agreed with, but I realized like, you know, I don't want to go back to, you know, insane asylums where they're like horrible conditions and they're just, you know, fucked up.
No, we don't want padded rooms and electroshock.
Yeah.
No one.
It's
got to
be modern. Yeah, it's got to be modern. It's got to be
in nature. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we know that, but we're not even trying. All they do is cry about Reagan did this, Reagan did that. We can fucking make mm-hmm. another mental health hospital then. Jesus Christ! Yep. Like, it's just insufferable performative altruism. It's just all they do is just victimhood and all this. It's just, you know, people are over it. So there's another, that's the last layers. You've got to, like, these are open-air drug zones. We have over 300 encampments in Oakland. It's triple in the last 3 years. But there's like 8 to 12 that mm-hmm. are doing the most harm. So when you say we don't have enough housing for everybody, you have enough housing to offer those people, but they ain't going to take it anyway. Then you close the encampment mm-hmm. and you enforce the law. They don't want to do that because it's the optics and the activists and all of this, you know, it's woke nonsense. But now they're rejecting it because politically it's backfiring. And that's what I mean by the chameleons. You got to be careful for, you know, the shapeshifters and who are going to just all of a sudden, oh no, 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 I'm not woke anymore. I actually want more. We are defunders who are calling for more cops. Like, you just said no more cops. Yeah. No more cops. Yeah. Like, bro, like, come on, man, you fucking clown. Are you serious? Like, at least go to, at least like, mm-hmm. you know, be honest. Be honest. Look, if sticking your guns, here's a big issue I have with activists right now in Oakland. I wish you could see my room. It's Black Panthers and dudes with guns all over the place.
Hey.
they love to be like, we're just like the Black Panthers and blah, blah, blah. Even though they don't have no guns and they don't like them.
Bless you.
Excuse me. But Frederick Douglass says, and I quote, power concedes nothing without a demand, never has, never will. And I say demands come with consequences. So as a union organizer, a negotiator, the first question I ask is, what do you want? We want this. Okay, you want me to make a demand or you want me to ask for it? What you mean ask? We want you to make a demand. You want you to be tough. You're the negotiator. You got to go to the table and get up what we want from you. We pay you a lot of money. I says, okay, are y'all ready to strike? And if they say, yeah, I say, okay, let's take a strike vote. If they get that strike vote, I go make demands. I bang on the table. I tell boss man, fuck off.
Yeah.
But if they ain't ready to strike, oh, I don't know about that. My job is to get you what you want. Let me tell you, I can't make no demands on your behalf because mm-hmm. you can't levy any consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to act. And when you act, you engage in interest-based bargaining. And what interest-based bargaining means is you get the person you're negotiating with to agree to a general direction. Let's call it, we're going to sail to this destination, this island. You may have some storms, you may have to redirect course, but everybody knows what island you're going to. And as long as they operate in good faith and you keep them in the boat, then you're making progress toward the island and you can sell that to your constituents while you organize to make demand. An effective mm-hmm. leader knows the difference, who actually wants to get something done. That's what I learned as a union organizer and negotiator. The difference between asking and demanding and how to actually prepare to make demands.
Mm-hmm.
You can do both, right? It's not mutually exclusive, but you need to know the order of operations, to your point of how you're going to do that. Activists love to make all these demands and talk all crazy, but they have no fight. They have no ability to levy any consequences because they don't even have the consent of the people they claim to speak for their so-called movement.
And then it creates a culture where it's just activists, saying these demands, or politicians, levying these demands, both absolutely no consequences. And so it becomes, a situation where, the people in the elites or people who you are trying to, win these individual, battles against, they start learning, there's not going to be actually any consequences with this quote unquote demand here. So, when you don't actually delineate what's the demand and what's asking, you're creating a culture where your demands are just going to be falling on deaf ears because it's like boy who cried wolf.
Vote blue no matter who.
Yeah. There has to be some leverage. There has to be leverage. And if you don't have any leverage, then you're just talking. And I think we're at a point now where people have low standards because of how jaded they are. And if it sounds good, that's all they need to hear. But without the leverage, then it's not going to happen.
Comes back to accountability, that's really.
For sure.
So what does leverage look like outside of elections? Because it's hard to win elections if you have no money. And independent candidates rarely win because no one wants to fund them. Hopefully that changes. Hopefully there are people out there who actually have some fiat or some hard tangible assets they can get some fiat from and direct that to people like myself and other post-partisan candidates and people like, Chris Smalls, if you want to support working people and not be, a bloodsucker. I would describe my political spectrum as somewhere between a welfare capitalist and a democratic socialist. And they're not mutually exclusive. It's a fluidity. We can rename them all you want. But basically what I'm fighting for is that if nature permits, everyone to have as close to an equal starting point as possible. From diet, nutrition, and I don't mean extravagant living conditions. I mean a diet that's healthy to feed your brain and living conditions that conducive to a healthy environment, right? Not being cooped up, having space, right? Like, you need privacy. Not your own room. I grew up in a bedroom with three of my siblings until I was, 15, 16, and we moved. It didn't hurt me. We had one bathroom for six of us in inner city Cleveland. And then we moved to the suburbs when I was 16 and had three bathrooms and five bedrooms or four bedrooms or whatever it was. And we all had our own room for once. It was great. But fundamentally, I had what I needed when I had a place to sleep and I had nutritious food from my grandfather's garden and I had two parents who loved me and devoted their time to raising a human who would care for other people. And that's what matters. Everyone deserves that. And that's what I fight for. And this political spectrum depends on what nature gives you or the constraints of life, right? It's fluid. Sometimes you need rugged individualism and sometimes you need, more collectivism and varying degrees of both. And I think anyone who's fixed in that position ideologically is has some soul searching to do and definitely shouldn't be trusted in a leadership position during a time of weeks and decades.
Yeah, I'll close this one out. Yeah. Well, this is a great conversation.
How about we give you a sec to plug your campaign and your social?
Yes, thank you. Please go to Seneca Scott for Oakland Mayor 2022. You can also Google Seneca Scott Oakland and the first thing that comes up is the website. Any and all fiat you got, any money you got to send me, anybody you can forward my website to helps. Mm-hmm. I understand that over 60% of Americans right now do not even have $1,000 for an emergency. So please do not send me money you do not have to prepare for what's coming in America. But there are still plenty of people who do have it. So if you have it and you like what you hear, send me as much as you can afford. If you're a person of means, and you like what you hear, and you want to sponsor me, you need to holler at me because I'm trying to get to the 576 so I can win this race. We can absolutely win this race if we're funded. Like, I have no doubt. Our message is killing it right now. You talk to me, you vote for me. The only way I can get to 90,000 people to vote for me, which is our identified target number, the last day of 150 is just a perspective, is bandwidth. That bandwidth comes from... Money, ad buys, right? Hiring more volunteers to knock on more doors to all the things that matter in politics. So it's really important that people support financially if you can. If you cannot, sharing it helps because you never know who's going to see it and who that person could be. I went to an event last week with some super hood dude who'll be stopping the followers and shit like this. This dude he ain't plugged, he ain't connected. I'll be connecting him with people to get money for his nonprofit. But he gives me, I'm not from Oakland, so he gives me the hood pass, so he tells people, this dude, we rocking with him, right? Mm. So I brought him to an event, and he loved it. And, it worked out so well that, he's become part of our campaign. And last week, he said, Seneca, there's a campaign for him. They're interviewing candidates. Why aren't you here? I said, I ain't heard about it, bro. He said, you got to get down in the Oakland Rotunda building right now. I said, yes, sir. So I go down there, and I'm like, hey, man, this is for the June candidates, bro. This is not for at Mayor. He's like, oh, my bad. And I'm like, it's all good. I talked to some people there. One of the dudes I talked to was a dude I've been after for a year who's turned down countless meetings. We end up connecting, going to his little secret office in the Rotunda. This dude's one of the heaviest dudes in the city. Now he's on board. Mm-hmm. See how God works? That's serendipitous, or that's God, however you want to put it, metaphysical, whatever you want to say. That opportunity would have been lost had I had dismissed that person or had I not jumped that occasion. So what I mean by that is you never know who you're going to put. That's a humble dude who didn't know that guy, but he still got me that guy. So if you can share it, share it. If you can give me money. Whatever you can do to help out, I'll help out.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. And yeah, I mean, like I was saying, I think there's a big and like you were saying, there's a big opportunity now for some of the things you're talking about in a different lane. And yeah, hopefully it spreads. Hopefully it's contagious. And makes other people think along in other cities as well. So
hey, from your mouth to God's ears, brother.
Hey, absolutely. But yeah, thank you, man, for coming on. This, I think, this is great. I'm very happy. I'm glad we had fun.
Likewise, thank you for the opportunity.
All right, that was part one of our episode. If you'd like to listen to part two, you can find that at patreon.com/fedpost. Thanks for listening.